he wanted or needed to know about she, a lady, and or I, and or the private secretary would all work together to try and find out what was on. So it was very much a team work sort of approach. No one had an individual job, except as press secretary, my job was to talk to the media, and we're pretty consistent that I was going to be either Withers or I were the only person who'd talk to the press, just to make sure that we kept our messages straightforward. And of course there was a lass who did everything, did the typing, typed the speeches for me, typed letters for Reg and or the private secretary, and made the tea and whatever. So that was a very small office, and of course Harold Young was our whip, and Harold would come into the office to talk to Withers, and together they'd sort of work out a battle plan for the day, which would then be passed on to the senators, and there'd be a stream of backbench senators or shadow ministers coming in to talk about this, that or the other. And of course when Parliament was not sitting, Rich would go back to Perth, and he'd deal mainly with electoral matters over in Perth, and the rest of us stayed in Canberra. Sensibly, he took the view that there was no point moving his staff backwards and forwards with him, because he'd been in a permanent state of jet lag, and basically it was much more valuable having the staff on the ground in Canberra. In government, things didn't change dramatically, except we had much more staff. The staff just about doubled. Nowhere near as big as the sort of staff ministers have today. It was we had a again, principal or senior private secretary, who through whom all paper passed, and the job of the senior private secretary was to determine what material needed to go into the minister, and what needed could go direct to the department to be dealt with, and what might need a reply to come back to the minister. What might be, so you'd have a little tick box sheet, sort of minister to see, minister to or department to reply, minister to reply, which meant that the department would normally draft a response. Very, very rarely would the minister write his own response to anything. Pretty well everything would go back to the department, where it would be where people who should be expert on the matter would be able to put the facts together, for better or for worse. Sometimes you had the feeling that they hadn't read the letter that they were responding to. And sometimes they were very, very impolitic. One of them, for example, it was just before Christmas, and we got a letter from some person who'd failed to vote in the election, and they'd received a letter from the electoral office threatening with a fine, and they hadn't paid the fine. So they were now being threatened with going to jail. And we referred that to the electoral office for a response, and the letter that came back basically said, go to pot. You've done the wrong thing and you should go to jail. And I said to Withers, look, you know, it's sort of Christmas time. I really don't think it'd be a good look if this man takes this letter to the... If you sign this letter and it goes, he takes it to the newspaper saying that the minister said he's a dirty dog, he should go to jail over Christmas, with which Rich agreed, so we sent it back to the... I think we may have redrafted the letter in the office to explain a little more that the need to comply with the requirements of the Electoral Act without quite... been quite so brutal. And I don't think that letter was sent off until after Christmas. there was a private secretary who would do much of the again, the sort of screening work with the lower level letters. And we had Reg had an appointment secretary who jealously guarded all his travel and appointments and so on, which would be done in concert with the senior private secretary and the minister himself. And I commandeered, when we moved from the opposition office just down the corridor into the government leader's office, and I acquired for myself an office that was right inside the entrance, so I could see everyone who was coming or going in to see the minister, because I found it useful to know who was in and who was out. Positioned it so that any journos who came in to see me had their backs to the door, so they, while I could see who was going in and out, they couldn't. The minister's office, in fact, it was interesting, they've retained the government leader's office over on the other side. It's changed quite a lot from our days, but when we were there, there was actually a secret closet behind the bookcases, and you had to go and press on the right spot on the wall of bookcases, and all of a sudden that bookcase had opened out, and inside was this little hidey hole where, I suppose, if you had any real secrets, you could keep them.
That's quite extraordinary, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so whether it's still there, I don't know whether people know about it or not. We knew of it from our predecessors who told us about it. I don't know whether Ridge passed it on to anybody. So for all I know, it may still be there.
Where was it again?
It was on the wall on this side, the wall that faces east, I guess. There's a row of bookcases, and one of those, you pressed the right spot. I can't remember where the right spot was. We acquired a huge safe, which wouldn't have fitted into that that cupboard, and that's where all the cabinet submissions and so on were kept. And there was only two people in the office were allowed to have the combination to the safe, so that it could be kept quite confidential.
Who were they? What position?
That was the senior private secretary and the private secretary.
Yeah.
They were the only two who could do that. I did not have the combination. Although, as things sort of happened, everyone, after a while, most people were able to open the safe if they really needed to. But we pretty well respected that wasn't done. I think I said the appointment secretary. After a while, we went into a period, a bit like where the government of today found itself not so long ago, where we had enormous problems with the backbench, and with the government was going down in the polls, as governments always do. And the backbenchers were complaining that the government message wasn't getting out, and that more should be done. So they formed themselves into a sort of a committee of angry backbenchers who took a deputation on to Withers and demanded that, as he was the Minister for Administrative Services, and as I mentioned before, sort of members' lurks and perks, he should do something about it. Ridge didn't really want to go and be harangued by all these backbenchers, so he gave me the task of going down and fronting them. And so I did, and it became pretty obvious, as is always the case, the backbenchers wanted to put out all the good news and didn't want to try and sell the bad news. And this meeting took place in a committee room, House of Reps committee room number one or two, I think it was, committee room down on there. And they were, so I quite bravely for a staff. I mean, in those days, staffers had nothing, none of the sort of power that staffers allegedly got today. You were supposed to do your job and be seen, but not heard, other than within the office itself. But I took it upon myself to effectively read the riot act to these blokes, and I told them that in no uncertain terms that their job was to go out and sell the government's message, for better or for worse. And if it was a tough message to sell, it was their job, that was what they were elected for. And fortunately, none of them could sack me, and I knew that this was basically the sort of thrust of what Ridge believed, so I felt fairly comfortable saying that. But we did come up with two things. One was the establishment of an organisation called the Ministerial Document Service, which simply just put every press release that a minister had made during the week into one little compendium and would then deliver it one way or another to each member's electoral office so that they could then make their own press releases and so on. And that actually worked quite well. The other thing we did, we agreed that it was more important for the Cabinet to take note of the consequences of its decisions, or rather, the political consequences of its decisions. Now, people might find this very hard to believe, but up till that time, which was about, right about 1976-7, Cabinet submissions, which were written in departments, would take into account a lot of the policy consequences of what was proposed, but not the electoral or political ones. So a decision that might be a very logical decision from the point of view of the public service would only have its political consequences tested if the antenna of the relevant ministers were alerted to it. And that didn't always happen because ministers were very, very, naturally enough, busy with all the things they had to do. So we created a front page for every cabinet submission, which actually required the minister to identify the people who were likely to be adversely affected, the groups who were likely to be positively affected, the measures that, or the arguments that might be used to counter criticism, and the cost, and a number of things like that. Which meant that it had a lot of value because it meant, and it was supposed to be filled in by the minister in his own hand or by a senior member of his staff, which which meant that within each ministerial office, a very senior person, if not the minister, would be required to think about the electoral consequences of any submission. And to the best of my knowledge, I've continued that today, although sometimes you wonder whether it's done. But in fact, I must try and dig that. I might be able to dig that out and send you a copy.
Sure.
It's so old, I don't think it'd be classified anymore. The new ones probably are. This wouldn't be. But what we found after a while was that trawling through the cabinet submissions, which were supposed to be only two or three pages, but the attachments had grown them out to maybe 30, 40, 50. It was almost impossible to get through and fill them all in, so we ended up employing someone to actually read every submission and then condense it down to a two or three-page summary for Withers and for me, because there'd usually be a press release attached, and we insisted that the press release would be done within the office for the reason, again, of trying to make sure that the politics of any issue were addressed before the event rather than after it hit the press and then you had to react rather than be positive on it. So that took up a fair bit of time. We also had a person from the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet who was the parliamentary liaison officer, and it was his job to liaise with his equivalent in the Prime Minister's office or the Leader of the House's office just to see what sort of legislation was timed to go in the House and then into the Senate, and what time it was supposed to come out
Who was that?
I can't remember his name.
No, it doesn't matter. We can find that out.
Yeah.
Not worry.
And so he'd share an office with the girl who, again, I can't remember her name. Jenny. Can't remember her last name. Who would scan through the cabinet submissions or would condense the cabinet submissions. And we had a dining room out the back. I think that's gone from the display, and a kitchen, and an attendant who was an ex-butcher. Barry was his first name. I can't remember his last name. And he did a great job of organising meals, most of which came from the dining room in Withers' suite, so he could entertain backbenchers or visitors or whatever in his own, so he had his own private dining room. And we had a nice little balcony that overlooked the rose gardens in the centre, and that was about that. The working day itself again started around about 8 o'clock in the morning, and usually around about 8:30, the head of the department, Peter Lawler, would come and brief the minister on whatever issues there might be, and find out from the minister whatever the minister might want him to do or get the department to do. And we had a person from the department who varied from time to time, who would come and assist in preparing the question time brief. So much of the activity, even out of session, would still revolve around Parliament and question time, what it was like to happen in question time. And the brief, of course, was prepared by the department and just dealt both with background to everything the department did, and then if there were issues running in the media, they'd be highlighted and they're updated so that the minister would actually have within his big book, big compendium, the right or the latest, most appropriate, accurate response, which was a lot more difficult to deal with than you might imagine, because sometimes, as I said, this compendium was about 3 inches, 4 inches thick, and sometimes there'd be two of them, and so you'd have to cross tab whatever might be important. So even though it was done alphabetically, the task of trying to find the right answer when a question was asked was still pretty difficult.
Yeah.
And so you'd have to spend some time trying to make sure the way it was indexed was as user-friendly as it could be. And then we'd usually find... I usually found that there were journalists from the gallery wandering in and out, just basically checking on whether there was anything happening that they should know about. You'd then have question time itself. I would usually sit out in the office listening to question time on the speaker. Well, one of the jobs that I shared with Fraser's office, Pedro Giorgio, who later became a Member of Parliament. Pedro was on Fraser's staff. Pedro and I shared the task of writing condolence motions, because amazing how many people died in those days. And virtually every second day in Parliament there'd be a condolence motion, either for a former Member of Parliament or a dignitary of some sort, or a foreign dignitary. And not sure that we should record this, but one day the President of India, whose name was Farc Rudin, died. and we had to do a condolence motion, and it was my job to do it. And one of the things we did in that, in those days, the ABC had a thing called something like the Committee on Spoken English, and its job was to ensure that ABC presenters had the correct pronunciation of every word that was uttered on the ABC. It is a great tragedy that they have, that committee seems to have gone into abeyance. But so I checked, what we would do is check with this committee to find out, make sure that the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Government and the Senate both pronounced the name of these people exactly correctly. And so I rang and asked how this name was spelled. And sure enough, it was as you'd think. So I wrote this speech, a copy of which went down to Fraser's office, and to make sure that Withers and Fraser both pronounced it correctly, I regret to inform the House of the death of the President of India, Mr. Farquharson Bracken, pronounced blank CK Rudin. And we'd written these speeches so often, and the Minister and Prime Minister had read them so often that I'd just accustomed to reading it out without thinking about it. Of course, so Hansard fortunately does not record it, but as it went through, both of them said, with deep regret, I inform the House of the death of the President of blah, 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 pronounced. And I don't think either of them spoke to me for a couple of days after that.
Okay, so they weren't appreciative of that. Yeah.
It probably caused a ripple of laughter. But then... if particular issues were on in the Senate, sometimes I would go to the Senate gallery and sit in the advisor's chair and pass notes over to the boss. Then the afternoon would be spent, come out of Parliament and spend most of the afternoon either talking to departmental officials and or dealing with the submissions. And of course, the amount of paper that comes over a minister's desk is phenomenal. I don't think people comprehend just how much comes through. And even if you've got people outside who are shifting stuff over to the department for response or reply, those things that you've sent over for a response still come back. And Reg would come in very early in the morning to just go through the correspondence. Although we'd start at about 8, he'd often be in here about 6:30, just working through things when it was nice and quiet. The afternoon, as I said, the permanent head might be over again. If not, he'd go through his papers, and or I and his senior private secretary would have a discussion about what was going on, how it might be handled, gossip about this, that or the other. The whip would come in and again be given their instructions as to how we wanted things to be played. And then dinner, we'd adjourn for dinner. Sometimes I'd go home, sometimes I'd work through. And of course at night it started to get fairly dull and quiet, and but you still had to stay here. And there'd be the occasional journo would come down and chat for a while. And then when Parliament got up, Reg would normally have drinks in the office for anyone who, firstly for anyone he particularly wanted to talk to, and secondly for anyone who wanted to drop by and have a drink. And so we'd hang about after the House had got up, probably for half an hour to an hour, and then go home. And then the next day it'd start off pretty much the same. So that was the routine for what it's
No, that's good. No, good to know that, and it's a complete, very full answer, so I thank you for that. What about the sort of relationships within the office? Were they smooth, or were there hostilities that developed? Or
Oh, I think in our office we did have a pretty good team of people who did work well together for most of the time, not all the time. Certainly, with Reg's original private secretary Robert Maher, I had a very, very good close working relationship. We worked very well. Rob left, and a new guy came in, and from time to time that would get a little bit tense, but we both worked fairly hard to try and make sure it was cooperative and workable, and it was. In those days, I suppose, there was probably a lot more chauvinism than there is today, so I suppose the boys tended to hang out together, and the women in the office were probably felt that they were regarded as second-class citizens, I suspect. By and large, things worked out fairly well. There'd be some tension on sitting days, particularly before question time, when we were trying to get that brief I was talking about together. But by and large, the thing worked not as a well-oiled machine, but it worked it was pretty friendly. And we'd, on Fridays, we'd usually have lunch in the office. Barry would organise a collection of salad things from somewhere. We never really knew where they came from. And we'd all sit down, including him, and perhaps someone would get a bottle of wine or something like that. We'd sit down and just have a chat about how the week had gone. And usually Friday afternoon was not much work done, unless something suddenly occurred to make us put our heads down.
Good. I wanted to move on now to the topic of prime ministers. You know, we've got the Australian Prime Ministers Centre here, so we always like to ask people if there are any anecdotes that provide insights or help understand the people who were prime ministers. Did you have much contact with, you know, the earlier people like McMahon and Whitlam?
Well, one way or another, I saw every prime minister from including Menzies on, but my experience with Menzies was extremely limited. I went and reported a couple of things he opened in Sydney, and that was about that. And so I don't think, I certainly wouldn't say that I knew him by first name, nor he me. Gorton I got to know reasonably well when he was Minister for Education and Leader of the Government in the Senate. And he was pretty much the sort of what you see, you get. Gorton's public persona was almost exactly the same as his private one. He had a good sense of humour. He was a bit of a character. He'd been a pilot in World War II, and I suppose all little plain jockeys are a bit sort of cocky and self-opinionated. He knew very much he had pretty much total faith in his own convictions. He certainly would not suffer fools or incompetence easily or lightly. He probably got a little bit carried away. I think he basically had a take me as I am or kick me out sort of attitude. Love me or leave me, you know. Whereas his predecessors, including Holt, though Holt was nowhere near as much a sort of tower of towering presence as Menzies. But Gorton didn't really care what people thought of him, and wasn't quite crash or crash through, but he was so self-confident, I don't think he ever seriously thought about the consequences of his actions. And of course, he started to come under, he didn't appreciate, I don't think, the level of opposition that was bubbling beneath the surface within the party, particularly from McMahon. And he made his first mistake, of course, was taking a girl from the gallery, Jerry Willissey, out to the American Embassy late one night, when I think Ed Clark was still the ambassador. Whoever was the ambassador, doesn't really matter. And word got around about that. I'm not sure whether Jerry told people about it herself or whether it came out from the Americans or what, but he took her to the embassy late at night, and then I think took her home. And of course, this was scandal, horror, shock. Now, I don't believe anything untoward happened other than being a bit dopey of the Prime Minister to arrive at the American Embassy with a girl reporter in tow. But it's funny, up until that day, I think any Prime Minister's dalliances went totally overlooked by the media. Perhaps because it was the Americans involved, or maybe because it was Gorton, this was big news. And it started to... It was used, I think, by his opponents to argue the case that his judgment was very poor. But overall, he was a very affable, very approachable guy. I never saw him lose his temper, though he probably did. He became quite sour, though, and when Fraser became a leader, he left the party. He couldn't abide, because Fraser had been the instrument that caused his downfall, as probably known. From Fraser was Minister for the Army. Gorton was Prime Minister. Fraser felt that Gorton had not supported him on an issue, the details of which I can't recall. And Gorton allegedly briefed Alan Ramsey about this. Fraser found that offensive, went into Parliament and resigned. Gorton denied that he'd briefed Ramsey about it. Ramsey was in the gallery and yelled out, "You liar." Alan Reid ushered Ramsey out of the gallery because everyone was infuriated and embarrassed. Things went on and on until that came to a head, and there was a party meeting, and typical Gorton, the vote was tied, so Gorton used his casting vote to vote himself out. But he was very, very bitter about Fraser's actions there, and so he left the party, and he ended up becoming a rather, not bitter, but a sad old man, and he drank too much. And I went out to, when I was writing the book about Peacock, I went out to see him to get some background at his home in Red Hill, and the place was a mess. His wife had died by then. He was living alone, and he gave me a drink early in the day, and I felt it was very, very sad that a man who'd been Prime Minister had ended up such a sad and lonely figure. But then there was, I didn't talk about Holt. I didn't really know Holt other than seeing him in Parliament, so I can't really go into much detail about Holt. Billy McMahon, he was a funny character. He was actually quite a likeable old bloke. And I've mentioned before about how he and my wife would have these Sunday night telephone trysts. He went into Parliament one day. When he succeeded Gorton, of course, he'd made a lot of enemies on Gorton's side, one of whom was Jim, the principal one being Jim Killen, who was sent off to the backbench. And one day in Parliament, Billy got up and said, "Oh, I'm my own worst enemy." And this voice came from the back saying, "Not while I'm alive, you aren't." And that was Jim Killen.
Yeah.
He was a very, I understand, he was a very poor chairman of the cabinet, which probably Gorton was too. Like all prime ministers, they like to get their own way, and that then creates tensions within the cabinet. Billy himself, as I said before, was almost perpetually on the telephone talking to anyone he could about anyone he wanted to, anyone who he wanted to.